So, in my opinion, today's reading from Matthew should probably be experienced as Act 3 of a play. The first act is the parable of the lost sheep, in which a shepherd forsakes everything to go find and retrieve the one who is lost. The second act we read last week, and it consists of Jesus telling the disciples how to handle situations of conflict, ending with the instruction that if the offending person won't respond to reasonable intervention, they should, quote, be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Act 3 is what we read today, the command to forgive 77 times, and the parable of the unforgiving servant. So if we are paying attention to this three-act play, we see a parable of extravagant forgiveness, a monologue that seems to suggest a three strikes and you're out policy, followed by a parable that insists upon forgiveness as a way of life. That forgiveness sandwich, together with Jesus telling his disciples that the unrepentant person shall be like a Gentile or a tax collector, should cause us to suspect that Act 2 is a speech in which Jesus is using irony in order to provoke his disciples into a new way of living. Because who was Jesus constantly inviting to dinner? Tax collectors, and then Gentiles. What was Jesus practicing in his life? Radical grace and forgiveness. What was the overarching teaching of Jesus to his disciples? Follow me in the way that seems like death in order to find your life. Because what looks like death is actually the opening into a life of love and wholeness. And you may argue with me. You say, no, Carissa, what Jesus was teaching was love. And I will argue back that at first, love may feel like death because it requires us to let go of self-protective systems and strategies in order to embrace a different way of moving through the world. Jesus was teaching love and death and resurrection. Consider a woman who leaves an abusive spouse for a long time. That choice will feel to her like death, the death of a marriage, the death of the hope that if she could just find the right way to respond, her spouse would change. The death of some measure of security. She risks wrath and retribution. At the same time, her action is one of profound love. She is honoring the image of God within herself and within her spouse by removing herself from ingrained patterns of harm. She is choosing a greater love over manipulated love. And she is placing herself on a trajectory that will one day allow her the capacity for forgiveness from within the realm of safety and wholeness. Now back to Peter and Jesus. I think Peter caught the irony in Jesus' voice when he suggested that after three strikes, the person should be like a tax collector. In today's passage, Peter is essentially asking, okay, I see that forgiveness is what you are really calling us to, and forgiving someone two times and then dropping them isn't what you really propose. So would it be more like seven times? And Jesus says, more like 77, actually. And that 77 is a clever reference to and a reversal of a story found in Genesis, one of the early stories, where a man named Lamech boasts that anyone who crossed him would be avenged 77-fold. And so if that myth, which represented the birth of vengeance, of record-keeping, there is this new story that Jesus is telling, introducing a life of grace. And so Jesus tells a parable. It begins with a king doing what we might expect. He reviews his accounts and requires that debts be settled. This is the way of the world. It is recognizable, as is requiring punishment in some form from someone who has racked up more debt than they can pay. In this story, the servant owes the king the equivalent of 6 million days worth of wages. That is never going to get paid back. So the servant falls to his knees, begs for patience, and promises something he cannot possibly do, to pay the king everything he owes. And something unbelievable happens. The king is moved by compassion, not by the man's promise, but by compassion for the man and his family. The king accepts a kind of death, a death of the feudal system that enriches him and secures control over others. He dies to his life of profitable bookkeeping, crossing off what in today's money would be a $10 million debt. But the servant does not see this death, or that it is motivated by compassion. He seems to believe that through his promise to repay, he has somehow secured a favorable outcome. And he refuses to follow in the king's footsteps, dying to the way of settling accounts. In doing so, he misses out on the life he might have lived within the realm of grace. He chooses the organizing principle of winners and losers rather than the call to find one's life through losing it. Thus, he goes out and finds someone like himself, someone in debt, someone who also begs for patience. But instead of putting to death his own right to extract punishment and payment, instead of choosing compassion, the servant chooses to throw the other man into jail. The result is that he himself is handed over to torture. For torture, Jesus suggests, is what one encounters when choosing account settling as a way of life, rather than choosing grace and mercy. Earlier in this chapter of Matthew, Jesus says, "Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And some have read that to say that priests and bishops have the power to absolve or not, as if God's own mercy is contingent upon what leaders in the church choose to forgive. But others read it as a description of what we end up experiencing of the kingdom of heaven within our lifetime. Robert Farrar Capon, my go-to guy for the parables of Jesus, has written, "None of our debts, none of our sins, none of our trespasses, none of our errors will ever be an obstacle to the grace that raises the dead. But if we refuse to die, and in particular, if we insist on binding others' debts upon them in the name of our own right to life, we will, by not letting grace have its way through us, cut ourselves off from ever knowing the joy of grace in us. If I were to rephrase that, I might say that if we bind each other up with a mindset of perpetual bookkeeping, our experience of the present kingdom of heaven will be similarly bound and compromised. But if we loosen ourselves and one another from record keeping and account settling, we experience the present kingdom as one of freedom and come to know the joy of the practice of grace. And I suspect that this has to do with how we treat one another's sins, but also with how we treat money and debt. Our ability to hold money loosely is a pretty good indicator of our spiritual lives. It's why Jesus talked so much about money and the ways in which it creates a stumbling block to living a life that is marked by love and grace. Because we as humans are part of an interconnected creation, the earth finds itself impacted by our choices. When we are caught up in spiritually or financially binding oneself and others, the land and the water suffers. The trees and birds and the sky itself suffers. And when we choose to unbind, even to lose what feels like it belongs to us, grace is unleashed into the world that surrounds us. And the planet itself can breathe. Literally. We know that greed and account settling has a direct relationship to environmental harm. And I think greed and account settling is enabled by theologies that emphasize mastery over sin rather than acceptance of grace. Of theologies that emphasize triumphalism over the way of death and resurrection. So I'd like to read again the passage from Terry Tempest Williams' book titled Red. Philip read this just a moment ago. Williams is a writer, educator, and conservationist, a contemporary of our own. And she writes, "The eyes of the future are looking back at us, and they are praying for us to see beyond our own time. They are kneeling with hands clasped that we might act with restraint, that we might leave room for the life that is destined to come. To protect what is wild is to protect what is gentle. Perhaps the wilderness we fear is the pause between our own heartbeats, the silent space that says we live only by grace. Wilderness lives by this same grace. Wild mercy is in our hands." Wild mercy is in our hands. Today, at the altar, I will press that mercy once again into the palm of your hands. What will you do with it?